Good afternoon, and welcome to Beginning Biochemistry on this, the 17th day of January. Yes? Yes. All right, so let's cover the technical things. Biochemistry.prof141, or you can follow the link from where you're normally looking. I left it for you. This is Grove City College, and no one's surprised by that, right? Good. I always get the first detail right there after it's hit or miss. All right, so it looks today like it's the spring semester, but it's only a false thaw. Be sure to wear your long pants and your coats next week. It will be much colder. And you are enrolled in Chemistry 141. Yay. Beginning biochemistry. Let's all wave hi to Dr. Kreiley as he goes home. Goodbye, Dr. Kreiley. Have a good weekend. All right, so this is an introductory course to biochemistry, you might guess by the title. It's largely in the catalog to solve the problem of, if you come to college and you say, I'm going to major in biochemistry, there is utter sadness, because if you come to college and say, I'm going to major in chemistry, the first semester you take a course in chemistry. If you say, I come to college and say, I'm going to major in biology, the first semester you take a class in biology. If you say, I'm going to major in computer science, computer programming one is the first class you take. If you say, I'm going to major in biochemistry, traditionally you do not take a course in biochemistry until the fall semester of your junior year. Which isn't exactly fair now, is it? No, because there's this great glory, but it's guarded by 4, 8, 12, 16 hours of prerequisites in general chemistry and organic chemistry before we can really let loose and talk about biochemistry. So what is traditional, and I should give you a little bit of history lesson, biochemistry has only been an undergraduate major since the late 1970s to the mid-1980s. Prior to that, if you were going to be a biochemist, you went to college to be a physicist or a chemist or a biologist, and biochemistry was a graduate level discipline only. And then when you have a whole graduate department of biochemistry, you really want to have young students around because they're fun and fresh. They're not old and jaded like me. So you start an undergraduate major, right? And in the last 10 or 15 years, it's become popular to have an introductory course, like the engineers have an introduction to engineering, where they're having fun problems without any math. So they say, hey, I could do this. And then they turn up the math. And it becomes considerably less fun. Okay, right. So that's what we're here to do. And we're going to do lots of different things. We'll be reading in the primary literature and talking about that. We'll be doing some lab experimentation, real safety goggle, long pants stuff. And then every once in a while, I will talk to you for a long period of time, like I'm planning for the 2 hours on this Friday afternoon. But hey, you've all had lunch, right? And you're probably not going to have dinner until after 5 anyway. So it's okay. Where else would you want to be? Although, since it is a little bit warm, it's turning into good snowman snow. So you could be rolling some big snowballs. All right, so I am Dr. Shaw. Hello, everyone. Hello, everyone. Email, phone numbers, campus mail, office 340C is the third floor overlooking the PLC corner. Or when you're outside, it's the one with a few plants on that corner of the third floor. So if you can translate that to the inside, that's where I am. And if you want to find me any other time, there's a schedule there for the spring. So find me wherever you want. And we really can't have class on Monday because I'm here from 1 to 5 teaching biochemistry lab. Now you're thinking about that and saying, whoa, all the other labs are 2 to 5. What gives? Well, traditionally our labs were 1 to 5. And then the faculty member said, but you know, sometimes we have an 11 o'clock class and we want to eat lunch and set up for lab. It's really hard to have a 1 o'clock lab. So the administrative assistant allowed us to move them back to 1:30, and that lasted for exactly 1 year before we just moved them to 2. And labs all became 3 hours. But that lab really does take 4 hours on some weeks, so truth in advertising. All right, but you can find me through the middle of the day, through the afternoon. And hint, I'm usually there working in the gray or the white areas. So just come and find me, and I'm happy to talk anytime. But there's officially when you can find me. All right, and you have made it Friday afternoon at 2:30, and you're in STEM 155. Ah, good. Okay, so we got all those details right? Sorry, the class keeps changing days. It was Thursday, and then it was Wednesday, and now it's Friday. Sometimes I don't get it right. All right, so you're familiar with course objectives, how they're assessed, and how they correlate to the program outcomes. So upon completion of this course, TWSBAT, which is the educational acronym for the student will be able to, TWSBAT, identify and discuss the fundamental areas of biochemical investigation, right? That is, I want to make sure you understand what is in the domain of biochemistry, how biochemists approach problems in a way that's unique from, say, biologists or molecular biologists. And we will do that by what is known as a journal club. And in a journal club, someone brings a paper, a piece of primary literature where someone else has done experiments, and they talk about it. In upper level experiences, it'll be your job to bring that paper and talk about it. Here, it's my job to bring that paper and talk about it. However, comma, it is your job to look at it beforehand and write a brief summary. Those summaries are 250 words, and here's the fun thing about science. When I give you a word or a page limit, that is always in science the maximum, never the minimum, like it is in writing a humanities paper. Right, so you're familiar with the National Academy of Science? You've heard of the National Academy? You might think there's something called the National Academy of Science. Right, so they publish a journal known as Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, and they have a hard page limit of 5 pages. If your article, when typeset for the journal, is going to be more than 5 pages, they don't even look at it. Right. And the reason for that is that they're publishing everything from social psychology and economics all the way through to particle physics and astronomy. Right. So they want articles that are short and sweet. People will read outside their discipline. Right. So you can't have 10 or 12 page articles. So that's a maximum. We'll have some lecture assignments on particular topics that don't quite fit into that. And then we'll ultimately do a longer laboratory project at the end where you will get to write a longer, more formal paper. Yeah. All right. Then we'll also be able to read, understand, and extend selected papers from the biochemical literature. That is, we want to be able to approach a paper and not necessarily know everything that's discussed in the paper immediately. Right? But we want to be able to read and understand and then say, if we were in the position to do the next experiment, what would the next experiment be? Because while I can describe biochemistry to you, that's really not the fun part of biochemistry. The fun part is that someday you go into the lab with just a question and you work out the answer to that question. Right? So we want to build that skill of, okay, if this is known, what are some of the next questions we could ask and what do we need in terms of molecular systems and experimental techniques in order to be able to answer that question. All right, and then, just in case you were worried, perform, analyze, and interpret fundamental biochemistry experiments. So some weeks we will be doing lab entirely. Some weeks we'll mix lab in with some other sorts of discussions. But there is a lab component. All right, so 1, 2, 3 short. That, of course, you do know that I have to, at the end of the semester, demonstrate that you've learned and succeeded or mastered each one of those things. So if you're ever thinking, why are there only so few learning outcomes in a course? It's because it's more paperwork for us if we have more learning outcomes. We kind of mash them together to do less. But, oh no, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain who's telling you how the sausage is made. All right. Do you like sausage? Okay. All right, so there's one required material, which is the course website. You can either type in biochemistry.prof and follow the link, or biochemistry.prof141, or if you visit Brightspace in the course, there's exactly one announcement with that link in it, if you haven't found it already. And everything will be there, papers, protocols, details, and the like. All right, so this being Grove City College, the question most students ask after, am I in the right room and have I chosen the best seat? Right, you've discovered the unwritten rule that the seat you choose on the first day is your seat for all eternity. Mm-hmm. There were some alumni walking through the building today who graduated 2007, 2008. Right, they knew where they sat in particular classes because etched in stone. All right, so we're going to do a couple journal clubs, and you'll have to write a summary before them. We will talk about them, and then after that class where we've talked about them, you go back and write exactly the same summary. So same paper, same summary. Hopefully, of course, from a position of better understanding, right? So that as you read the paper a third time, once before class, as we go through it in class, and then as you write about it at the end, you'll say, oh, I understand why they did this. I better understand this experiment. I know why they chose this system. And hopefully you'll continue learning. The theme here is not so much to keep you busy doing the same thing twice, but to let you know that often when you approach a scientific paper, the first time you look at it, your eyes glaze over and start to spin in your head like you were a slot machine. And then as you become more familiar and more comfortable with it, you become better able to understand it. And often, particularly when you're starting to read the primary literature, we'll take scratching through a couple of layers before you say, yeah, I know what they were doing and why they chose to do that. Right? So we're going to review papers a couple times. And we'll also then have a chance to polish your writing skills. Maybe I shouldn't say this just yet, but you thought you were going to be a science major and avoid writing? Nope. go to graduate school. Everyone in the business knows the next experiment to do, right? Why some people become relatively famous is because they are better at publicizing their work than other people, which means they can write well and they can speak well. No, you don't get to climb your ivory tower and be alone for years at a time. Sorry, if you're the solitary type who were hoping for that, no, no fortress of solitudes here in science. You're always out on the streets dropping freight trains or catching falling buildings. For those of you who didn't get it, that was the Superman reference. Okay. A large portion of our grade is going to come from lab reports, so when we do a laboratory activity, whether it's all 2 hours or a section of the 2 hours, there's going to be some analysis, sometimes calculations, sometimes graphing, sometimes analysis, and a little bit of writing to follow that. So that is what's covered in lab reports, and they are not unlike what you've seen. However, they're usually considerably more directed than a biology lab report or a general chemistry lab report, in that there are often two or three or four particular steps, and do those particular steps, don't write a lot of extra things. Don't do a lot of extra reading, so pay attention to those when we get to the first one. I'll explain it more. There are two particular assignments that we'll hit throughout the semester. The first one of those is molecular visualization, right? The biochemical molecules are large organic molecules, and unlike some of the other molecules that you are familiar with, because of their unusual size, they will fold back upon themselves and form a very complicated three-dimensional structure. And there are three really good methods for elucidating those structures. And there are some people who do that for a living. Right? They are a structural biologist or a structural biochemist. And they solve structures for a living, but there's something called the Protein Data Bank, rcsb.org, if you're interested, the Research Collaboratory for Structural Biology. And they catalog all of the biochemical structures where anyone can go and download the coordinates, but that is a text file that says this atom is at these positions, X, Y, and Z units of angstroms, and it's not terribly illustrative. However, there are a number of software packages which will read that file and generate a three-dimensional representation in three-dimensional space, such that with a mouse or a trackpad, you can rotate, zoom, do all the sorts of 3D transformations. And so we'll learn how to use one of those packages and then use it for answering particular questions or problems. And so that's the visualization assignment. And then the other one that we'll broach is that in addition to structural information, there is a wealth of sequence data available, both the nucleotide sequences and the protein sequences. And there is an entire discipline of bioinformatics which is interested in mining and understanding those data. So we'll introduce you to that and give you a few problems to play with. And then we'll do a longer lab towards the end, which you'll write a more formal paper on, where you give it a title. You write an abstract, which is, wink, wink, 250 words that summarizes everything that's in the paper. So when I said your writing assignments are 250 words, I'm really trying to get you to begin to write the abstract well and get in the habit of being able to think, okay, I have this big corpus, and I only have 250 words to describe it. How do I do that well? Okay. Abstract, an introduction, when you go out and look at the literature, some methodology, some results, and some discussion, right? Classic scientific paper. And then 90% is the low A minus, 80% is the low B minus, and 70% is the low C minus. And you need 60% to pass. But this, of course, being Grove City College, we don't have to talk about numbers that low. Okay. All right. So there are some course policies. So we've already talked about journal clubs. You're writing beforehand. You're writing after. And the fun thing is there, and we'll talk about it in great detail before we see the first one, which comes in a couple weeks. There are some assignments we've mentioned. There are laboratory reports. You do have to work safely in the laboratory, and I'll give you a clue as to the key for deciding whether I need to wear long pants and have my safety goggles, or I can get away with short pants and no safety goggles on any given week in just a minute. All right, then, academic integrity, all work original and scholarly for this course. And I'm sure there was a long discussion of what scholarly work meant, how to cite sources. Uh-huh. All right, it's a really good idea to come to class. Okay, I think I said that one. If you need any accommodations, we can do that, no problem. And then here is the course schedule. So today is the 17th day of January, and our official topic, after we introduce the course, is science in the Western tradition. Right? We want to start in ancient history and work our way forward and understand not only how does Western science work and come to where you are today, but how does science behave? How do we learn things? What are some of the great lessons that you need to be familiar with if you want to pursue a career related to this? Gulp. That's not a big topic. Okay, we're going to start with Hippocrates, born 469 BC to the present, all in the next 100 minutes. Okay, then next week I'll be talking again biochemical history, and you'll note that there's a megaphone and a megaphone. Now, we don't use the megaphone very much anymore. But it was an amplification, non-electronic way for voice. So when you see the megaphone, that means that there's going to be a sizable point of class where I am talking to you, hopefully with you, but at least to you. So talking. And then on January 31st, you'll note that we add in the small round bottom flask. That's the universal symbol for we are going to do something laboratory that day or in class that day. So I'll talk for a while. We have a paper to read, and then there's some lab activities to do. On February 7th, we will discuss a paper. Right? So that'll be our first journal club, and you'll see that it has the icon of a small scientific paper. And now, if you haven't seen one yet, they do look like that if you hold them really far away. Okay, that's iconified. Now, you'll note that the first three have links. The next don't. The reason for that is that... I am pretty much free to do whatever I want here. All right, so I know what we're doing for the first 3 weeks, and I'm pretty sure I know what we're doing on February 7th. But as far as some of the other ones, it's entirely up to me to still write them. So I'm ahead a little bit, and I'll stay ahead of you. But don't be alarmed that there's nothing there yet. It's just I haven't finalized it. And as a general rule, I would say consider everything through the end of March pretty much set in stone for that's what we're going to do on that day, unless, of course, there's something that I need that doesn't come in on time. We may have to deviate. April 4th, April 11th, probably not going to do those things as scheduled. I have an idea for what the big lab activity is going to be, but I just need a couple days in the lab to make sure that it's going to work because, well, if I gave you something to do and it didn't work, you'd be sad, right? Right, because you believe that all laboratories work out if you follow the directions? No, you've learned that sometimes even your best intentions blow up in lab? Good. That's an important scientific lesson. The real question is how you react to that, right? Do you analyze and say, oh, here's where I've gone wrong, let me try again? Do you try another experimental approach? Do you punt on that question entirely and attack something else? Okay. All right. So there's a little note there that the course schedule may be changed because I know it will be. All right. So there is the syllabus and the overview of the course. Are there any burning questions? Can you find this? So visit Brightspace D2L. There's one announcement with the link here. Or you can always remember biochemistry.prof. And from the main page there, there'll be a link to this website. Either way works. All right. And then if you're curious, you can get to the individual topics without having to go to the end of the syllabus. Save you scrolling. And then the homepage, if you open it up, is going to be what we're doing that week. And it will change Sunday night. Right, so it'll always be current. So you really don't have to go unless you get behind. But you're not going to get behind, right? No. You really don't have to go anywhere else. It's always right there. Okay. So science in the Western tradition. Allow me to delight the screen, because that's done. I'm just going to write if it's okay with you. All right, so you live in the Western world, and now I don't mean by that you rode a horse and are wearing chaps and vests. But you are in the West. So really, I want to talk about Western science today. That's not by any means a full history of Western science, right? I just want to pull out some vignettes and some examples to give you a feeling of how things work and set some important points. The history of science is an entire discipline, right? So there are historians who focus on scientific discoveries and how understanding works. That's not what we're going to try to address today because, well, let's face it, that would be an entire course. And we only have 2 hours or slightly less than 2 hours. All right. Nor are we going to broach anything that is in the non-Western tradition, what would generally be Eastern science or Eastern medicine. Nothing there. So stay to the west of the Indian subcontinent and stop in California. That's about the Western world. And it's not a full story. Right. Just a bit or a few examples to help make a couple points which are going to be important in the future. All right, so let's take one example and work it through about 2,000 years of understanding, right, to see how the approach to and the description of and ultimately getting to the reasonable modern answer comes about. All right, so you recognize that as Valentine's Day is coming? You don't feel any pressure about Valentine's Day, do you? Good. All right, and so if we divide the heart, there are 1, 2, 3, 4 chambers, and you know what those chambers are. Right? There's the right atrium. See, I'm used to chalk, and the danger is if you make a mistake with chalk, it's easy to change. If you make a mistake with chalk, whiteboard, you really have to go all the way. All right, so the right atrium, the right ventricle, the left atrium, and the left ventricle. And now as you look at that, you might be slightly puzzled. Slightly puzzled? Okay, so anatomical position is standing arms at the side, palms forward, right? In this case, the ulna is down, the radius is down. They're not pronated and crossed, but they are separate. And when we talk left and right, it is always left and right of your patient, not your perspective. Right. So when I draw the right atrium here on the left as you see it, right, that is considering your patient in anatomical perspective. Do note if you are ever asked to perform surgery and, well, you take out the left one when you should have taken out the right one, there will be a medical malpractice suit coming your way. Okay? All right. And you're pretty familiar with pulmonary circulation in that there is a large vein which returns blood to the right atrium. That is the vena cava. And is it all right if we go human? It's okay. All right, so there's the inferior limb and the superior limb. For those of you who learned your anatomy from animals, it's usually the anterior and the posterior vena cava because animals typically are quadrupeds, right? And so superior refers to above and inferior below, not that one's better than the other one. I'm the superior vena cava. Now, it's all about position. And so you usually learn them as anterior and posterior because you're thinking not in man. And then you know that coming out of the right ventricle, right, that coming back here, is the pulmonary artery. And the pulmonary artery is going to direct blood flow to the lungs. It perfuses the lungs. It returns through the pulmonary vein to the left side or the left atrium. And don't worry, I'll draw in the blood flow in just a minute. That's also another one that might leave you puzzled slightly. Arteries take blood away from the heart. Veins return blood, not dependent on the oxygenation state, right? Because this is blood that's come out of circulation and it's going out the pulmonary artery, right? Because the heart is pumping it to the lungs. It is deoxygenated. It returns from the lungs more highly oxygenated by a vein, right? So maybe that'll come into a crossword puzzle someday for you. Arteries and veins defined on direction from the heart. Not by the oxygenation state of blood. And then blood is going to leave the left ventricle according to the large artery. And there's one that goes up and there's a couple branches, and that's not anatomically correct, but it's close enough for biochemistry, right? All right, let's see. Does the blue marker work? All right, so you know that blood, is going to return in deoxygenated state from systemic circulation to the right atrium. From the right atrium, it is going to be directed into the right ventricle. The atria or the auricles are more or less priming pumps for the ventricles. Right, blood is flowing in under a bit of pressure. It's flowing directly into the right ventricle. The right atrium is going to give that last little squeeze to fill up the ventricle as best it can. It then leaves by the pulmonary artery, which is going to start here and go behind and up into the lungs. Did I label the lungs? You know what the lungs look like, right? Lungs. Not the gills, the lungs. In the lungs, blood is going to be oxygenated, which allows me to change to my red marker, which I know works because I tested that one. Back the pulmonary vein into the left atrium. From the left atrium, again, just a priming pump to the left ventricle, and the left ventricle is going to send that out the aorta to other points in the body, including but not limited to the four coronary arteries, which I failed to draw because I have to draw them across and around the heart, and that just makes it complicated. All right, so this being 2025, I haven't surprised anyone, right? Besides the left and the right thing. If you haven't been introduced to that, you might say, oh boy, got to call mom and say, you know what college education you're paying for? Professor doesn't know his right from his left. Now, don't worry, you can call and say other things. I'm sure I'll give you something to talk about. So our story begins with Hippocrates. Hippocrates was born into a family of physicians. His father was a physician. Other relatives were physicians. He studied medicine. And he is born in 469 BC. I'm off by 9 years. Is that okay if I fix it? Oh, come on. He didn't know. He was 9 years wrong. Yeah, you can go home and say that. Didn't I warn you I'd probably give you something to call home and talk about? So 460 BC, and just to give you an idea of some compatriots, who else are the, okay, we should probably talk for just a moment about what are the general time frames that we refer to. So 500 AD is about the epoch where everybody's older than that. We call an ancient. We say that's antiquity. Now, of course, that's a historical definition. And then we've got some middle and dark ages to go on. And then about 1500, give or take a few years, there's the Renaissance, the renewal of learning and understanding. And then we get into, I don't know, depends on what your perspective of modern times is. Right. Some people might say 1800, some might say 1850, some might say 1900. You probably say, I don't remember anything before, you know, about 2016, so everything else is ancient. Okay. It's a danger of being young. Right. You think right now is everything. Then is nothing in the future. Never going to come. Don't worry. You will age. Let's put some other people in there just to give you an idea of what the ancients look like. See, there's my 469. That's Socrates. You've heard of Socrates, the Socratic method, right? High learning. Who else is in there? So Plato. Plato, not Plato. About 427 BC, and that means we need one other. Yeah. And Aristotle is 382. You see, I'm not a historian. I know these things offhand. 384 BC. Right. Now, those dates are not particularly important to us, but I just want to make sure that you understand that Hippocrates is really, really old on the people that you would classify as the key philosophers of the Greek and Roman eras. Right, so he's about the same age as Socrates, older than Plato and Aristotle, and, almost 80 years older than Aristotle. Okay, so Hippocrates. Medicine is the family business for him and his extended relatives, and the primary writing that he is responsible for is attributed to him. Series of writings, which are known as the Hippocratic Corpus, and a corpus is just a body of work in the same way that you probably didn't face corporal punishment in high school, unless you were homeschooled, and then mom and dad were free to issue corporal punishment at will. Right, but that's a body of work, and it's attributed to him, although more than likely not, it was a body that was developed over several hundred years in that general area, a Greek island. And the Hippocratic Corpus is a series of things which are primarily written. Aphorisms. And you're like, oh no, we got to cover history and literature. He said this was going to be a course about biochemistry, didn't he? Well, trust me, we'll get there. Let's see, aphorisms. I'll give you a semi-more modern example in a bit, but you know, the Proverbs have a lot of aphorisms, right? They're little pithy statements of wisdom that are usually easy to remember. Oh, let's see. Oh, I had a good one. Got to remember where it was. Where was it? Okay. Well, that's not the one I thought about, but it'll do. wisdom, through wisdom, is an house builded, and by understanding is it established. You know, fun little thing, easy to remember. Wisdom and understanding, really important. The great American scientist Ben Franklin. No? Didn't think of him as a scientist? So, he was interested in one problem that you're probably not familiar with. It had nothing to do with kites and keys. He studied it over the course of 20 years, and he made some conclusions about it that if he had just done a little bit of math, he would have won the 1908 Nobel Prize. Because Irving Langmuir, the chemist, did essentially the same thing and just did some measurements with it and discovered the size of small organic molecules and won a Nobel Prize. You are familiar with the Nobel Prize, right? Okay. All right, so aphorism, short, pithy, easy to remember, important statements. Fish and visitors stink after 3 days. Neither a borrower nor a lender be. You know, aphorisms. And there were guiding principles that run through all of the Hippocratic corpus, all of these aphorisms, and the essential treatment of disease and understanding of disease throughout this region at this time. And those principles are really important. One of the Hippocratic themes was that illness has a physical cause. Now, we have to set that in opposition to other prevailing views at the time where, I don't know, you're familiar with Greek and Roman mythology, right? There was this world up there where there were greater and powerful beings that they called the gods, but unfortunately they had, with great power, some of the lesser exciting human characteristics of being mean and petty and vengeful, right? And so lots of people were viewing in that sort of pantheon of deity that, oh, you have angered the gods and therefore you are sick. Or it was more of a mythological understanding that the black cat has crossed your path and now you're sick. Right, so Hippocrates is really the first one in history who says, no, when there's illness, there is something wrong with the body physically. And more importantly, that physical malady is something that we can understand. And by extension, then, if we can understand it, we can do something about it. Sounds like Western medicine? Okay. Let's see. We could probably mention the Hippocratic Oath right now, but it's linked for you to read about later. Sorry, if it's been there for a while, have to use solvent to get it off. So it's a little slower than the chalkboard, but we can handle it, right? Right. And then we have to wait just a moment for it to dry, or else the end of the marker gets wet and then nothing works. Okay, so the first statement you acquiesce to, the second statement you might find a little bit foreign, and that is that health and disease are caused by the humors in the organs. That is, the general view was there is something in the body. If that something is in very good balance, you're healthy. And if those things are out of balance, then you're unhealthy. So what are the organs and what are the humors? So the classic organ that Hippocrates was interested in, well, he liked the squishy gray stuff between the ears. That's good. Right? That seems to be an important organ. There's a big one right across the midsection, so it must be important because it's really big. So the liver was one of those organs. He was really big on the spleen. Maybe he was onto immunity. Don't know. Spleen probably wouldn't be my favorite organism to focus on, but sorry, my favorite organ to focus on. Too much teaching biology there. And then, you thought I just told you about circulatory physiology for fun, didn't you? Now, you put a lot of emphasis on the heart as a key organ. And then there were also four humors. And yes, I will go with the British spelling there. You can go with the English spelling, it's okay. It doesn't really matter. All right, so there was, or to put it more particularly, the humors were the fluids that you find in the body. And so the big humor was the blood because, well, you know, you've got a fair amount of that. And if you lose a lot of it, really bad things happen to you. Right? So that's a good one. And then the other three humors were black bile, yellow bile, and phlegm. And now you're thinking, oh boy, this is going to get disgusting in a hurry. Nah, we're mostly interested in the heart and blood. It's okay. All right, now I am going to have to eliminate my heart from the board in order to talk about what the humors meant. I'm sorry about that, but you can memorize that structure. Good. All right. Red does not erase as well as black does. Okay. And so the general Hippocratic view was if the biles are balanced, if the humors are balanced, you're good. If the humors are out of balance, you are ill. So it seems pretty forward, pretty straightforward, right? You have the right amount of phlegm, you're good. You have too much phlegm, you're sick. Now, that from your perspective is probably not the cause of your illness, but it certainly is an interpretable symptom of your illness. Right? So you've had to sit in class next to someone who had too much phlegm. Uh-huh. And you just try to move as far away from them as you can. Recognize that there is a infection and you want to avoid the infection. Now, here comes the delicate and difficult part, depending upon your perspective. And it helps if I can spell, but that's okay. You'll get used to it. So the general Hippocratic view was that the balance of humors is unique in every individual, meaning that what gives me health, my balance of humors, is not necessarily the same balance of humor that gives you health, which meant that if you were going to be a physician, you couldn't have your patients come in and in a 3 to 6 minute office visit, diagnose them and send them on their way and have them have any chance to be healthy.
Right.
The physician must know their patients. And in particular, to know your patients means that you work with your patients, you live with your patients, you eat with your patients, you are intimately involved in their lives. And so in this way, you can sort of understand the extended Hippocratic family, right? If we've got to work and live and eat with the people who are going to be our patients that we're going to treat, we have to have a whole lot of physicians, right? Because while maybe I work with it was going to be good before I messed up the delivery. Maybe I work with 149 other faculty members here at Grove City College, but the number of those faculty members that I talk to in any given day, very, very small. Right? So let's see. Ooh, I talked to Dr. Foster today, so I know what's going on. But Dr. Tedford, no, haven't seen him since Sunday. So is he well? I don't know. Music, by the way. You don't know Dr. Tedford. All right, so clinicians work, eat, live. Kind of sounds like personalized medicine, doesn't it? Right, the idea that each patient with their unique physiology will be treated in a different way. Right, to put it another way, if you think about the large ticket pharmaceutical things, the ones that are advertised during football games on the ads, right? They often only work for a third of the population. And when you prescribe one of those, you can then give different doses, right? So if there's anyone who was over at Christmas and said, oh, the doctor is changing my medicine, I'm not feeling very well, right? The problem is we got to find just the right balance for each unique individual. And while we have some good ideas at the starting point, there's a little tweaking, right? Your doctor has to know you. You have a unique physiology. So not that far off. The general idea that balanced state gives health and unbalanced state gives illness, that's certainly not unique to Hippocrates. The Hopi tribes, native populations of North America, they describe koyaanisqatsi, the unbalanced life, life out of balance, the crazy life, right? To say that when things are good, everything is in balance, and when there's too much of one thing, you're out of balance. You know, Ricky Martin described it as living la vida loca. It will wear you out. Sorry, I tried. That's a late 20th century reference, but you got it. Good. Okay. Ricky Martin works. Let's see. My Taylor Swift references aren't good, but I know they will work. Ooh, I should probably also mention AC still at this point. Y'all down with AT still? Kansan? 19th century? Okay. Physician attached to a regiment that served in the Civil War largely came to the conclusion that everything that was known about medicine at that point in practice was more or less wrong. Went back to Kansas and started the School of Osteopathic Medicine, the founder of osteopathic medicine, where getting to know your patient is a big deal. Manipulations, health and well-behavior is better to prevent disease than it is to treat it. Okay. Phew. AT still, if you're curious. Let's see. And then there's got to be a third one, right? It's probably a number two. And the third and final big Hippocratic idea was that nature has a healing power. That is, what's normally going on when you're ill? You run a fever, you may have a discharge, there may be some swelling, right? Those sorts of normal things. They were referred to as sweating the humors. So if you had a wound that you got in the field that was infected and you had a lot of pus, you were sweating the humors, and that was good, right? You know a little bit about the immune system? You know, that's not that bad. You were vomiting? Hey, there was some probably yellow bile. You're sweating the humors. And so those sorts of things that you see and know about in response to infection, injury, other illness, they saw them as perfectly normal. It was the body's way of returning the humors to balance. They were out of balance. All right, so Hippocrates, don't worry, we'll get back to the heart, right? It's one of his organs, and blood is really important, but it allows me to go back to the beginning of Western medicine and probably Western science too. Okay, let's be a little more particular. Galen. Galen is born somewhere around 129 AD. Right, note that's an AD. The previous one for Hippocrates was a BC. So 460 and 129 means we've got a span of 489 years. Do a few things happen in the world during that time? So to put it in perspective, most of the New Testament is written 50 to 80 AD, right? So that's about the time frame. Galen is also from a Greek isle. And his father is a wealthy architect. His father is a wealthy architect, and he says, hey, my son is going to become a professional. But he does give him a little bit of leeway to choose his profession. And Galen chooses medicine. And so he gets to go off and study. He learns what they know about medicine in interesting places. And then he returns to his hometown of Pergamum. I was going to try and be clever. And he becomes physician to the stars. But setting you up for a period shortly after the writing of the New Testament is going to give you an idea of who the stars are. What was great Roman entertainment?
Colosseum.
Yep. What had happened in the Colosseum? Aha. So Galen becomes physician to the gladiators in Pergamum.
One might say he was the first trauma surgeon.
All right, and so he becomes a little bit of a hero because he is helping the people who entertain the crowds. And if a gladiator can win and be rehabilitated and come back and win again, right, you build up that little bit of cult of personality. Everybody gets excited. So he ends up having a fairly high status in Pergamum, and he goes back home. Not back home, but he goes back to the center, to Rome, and starts to write about anatomy. Now, when he writes about anatomy, he doesn't do human dissections, right? Even though one would imagine that if you had been physician to the gladiators, you would know a lot about open skin and broken bones and severed limbs and human anatomy. But at this time and in that culture, it's just not acceptable to dissect cadavers, right? There's a feeling that the human body has some sacred character, and if you're found cutting them open, you're labeled as being peculiar, weird, strange. So he's sort of confined to anatomy, but only by animal dissection. Which means that he's not really going to get the full human story, right? He's going to have a slightly shaded or distinct view. And he writes a large number of books on the medical theme. A lot of them are really revisions of Hippocrates. That is, he's not doing a lot of physiology. He's preaching the humors, right, and the extent of the humors. So he's rehashing Hippocrates and adding in some anatomical knowledge. And when it comes to circulatory physiology, the thing that he suggests I do know how to spell left, even though I put my two consonants in the wrong order. So his idea on how the heart works is that he recognizes the blood comes from the heart and into the right side of the heart, right? Because there's a difference from, or there's a big difference between a vein and an artery when you open up an animal, in his case, and look at them. Arteries are large, muscular, right? The aorta looks a bit like a garden hose. Veins are much thinner, right? They don't have the muscle to respond to a bolus and contract back against it. They are weaker and more flaccid. And his view is that blood enters the right side of the heart and it gets to the left side of the heart by passing through really small pores between the ventricles. Now, if you've ever seen a steak, right, that's skeletal muscle. Cardiac muscle is relatively similar on the growth scale. And so what he's suggesting is that there are small pores between that muscle mass, the septum between the ventricles, and so he suggests that blood passes from the right side to the left side directly, bypassing all of pulmonary circulation, but who's counting? All right, so we advance roughly 500 years, and it's a rehash of what we've seen before with one idea about circulatory physiology that probably makes you nervous, based on when we drew the diagram earlier. And you said, yeah, I can agree with that. Okay, so we're an hour in, right? Shall we take a 10-minute recess, stretch, get a drink, wander around, make more fire? Okay, so 40, when the minute hands at the 8. We'll start again with who comes after Galen in our story. All right, then. Let's return to the theme. And, well, if Galen is born circa 129 AD, let's jump a few years to Vesalius, who's born in 1514. Location is Brussels, right? And for those of you who are counting, we have skipped over all of the Middle Ages and are now in the Renaissance. Okay. Vesalius decides that he wants to be a physician. And where do you go if you want to go to medical school? Yeah, you head to Italy. You go to Padua. And he goes to medical school. He takes the final exam at medical school, and he does really, really, really well. So well that the day after,
the people who are running the medical school ask him to teach
medicine. So when he graduated, hey, will you be our professor? Right, so he hangs out in Padua, he keeps teaching for a few years, and then, like everybody else, you know, working every day is not that much fun. He goes off and begins to study anatomy. But in particular, since we are considerably further along in history, he begins to dissect cadavers and gets a view of human anatomy, not necessarily for the first time, but for the first time that he lays it out, someone lays it out in a complete and systematic way. Now, just a word of note.
So, before him, did they believe in the vitals still?
It's somewhere Galen's mostly writing like Hippocrates, and it's kind of fallen out of favor, but it's hard to say. Right, depends on the tradition. There's a lot of different things going on in different places. I'm kind of hitting the highlights of the circulatory story. So possibly yes, but I won't commit to that. Okay, now, before we talk about cadaver dissection, do note, of course, that if you're in Italy, which is a Mediterranean climate, and you want to work with cadavers, you have to work really fast. Right, so the digestive system has a number of bacteria that, you know, does away with itself really well when an organism dies. Right, you may have seen the animal along the side of the road that's well swollen, and you know not to go up and poke it with a stick, because something very bad is going to happen. Okay. And so he would work on some things like the head and the digestive system really fast, and some other things could hang out. The other thing that he did, that biochemists also did in the early part of the 20th century, was he constrained his anatomical dissections to...
I'm sorry, question on the head.
Uh-huh. So where they were coming from? So he's at a medical school, which one would assume there's a hospital associated with. And so, you know, there's a free flow. Yes, at this point there are probably some people who are unattached, that when they die, no one's coming to claim and bury them. It's probably also pretty expensive to be buried, so there's some people who are donating, happy. But he's going to do most of his dissections in the winter and then spend the spring and summer and fall writing about it. Right? And so he ends up writing a large book on anatomy. Right? This is the Renaissance, so we're now drawing things in perspective and making them realistic. I know you haven't taken Civ Arts yet, but that'll be one of the things they tell you about. As opposed to being flat two-dimensional representations, we now begin to model three dimensions on two. Right, so he hires a painter to illustrate the book and makes a really great book on anatomy, but the word was supposed to be no, but we'll fix that. His strong work in anatomy leads him to say there's no small pores between the left and the right side of the heart. Right? They are unique and distinct. The right chamber and the left chamber of the ventricles, two different things, no direct connection. And so Galen, who writes in 129 AD, isn't directly contradicted until 1500. Okay, it's a little bit later than that because he's born in 1514. So by this point, he's in his 30s or 40s. So we'll say 1550. That's entertaining, but we've got to go through all the details, and then we'll make the point. Right. So at the end of the story, the full description of circulatory physiology comes about by the Englishman by the name of Harvey, born 1578. He also likes to study anatomy. It's not a big deal to dissect things. But Harvey also really has another passion. And that he likes vivisection. He likes to dissect organisms which are still alive. And in particular, he really likes reptiles because their heart rate is dependent on their temperature. So he can cool them down, perform his vivisection. They still go for a long time at a relatively slow rate, and he can watch things reasonably well. And he is the first one who describes pulmonary circulation. Blood returns from the body to the right side of the heart, to the lungs, from the lungs to the left side of the heart, from the left ventricle to the body. So it is after 1600, that circulatory physiology is finally written down in the way that you know it. When I introduced it, you said, yeah, that makes perfect sense. That idea is early 1600s. Okay, now, after an hour of that discussion and that long history lesson from 460 AD to 1578 or the general advance of science is a slow, regular, methodical progression. That is, we see 2,000 odd years of history from the first discussion of the heart as a really important organ until the Englishman has the courage to open up a living organism and actually watch it. Okay, maybe courage wasn't the right word. The audacity, the nerve, the lack of caring, the disrespect for all that is good and holy. Depends on where you fall on the spectrum of animal protection, I guess. But science is a slow, steady development. And in that slow, steady development, the early ideas lead to those that follow. That is, Hippocrates wrote things, Galen read those things, Vesalius wrote things, right, all the way up until we have someone who says, hey, here's what I know about anatomy. Everyone else's answer has been unsatisfactory based on what I am observing in my reptile, in my vivisection tray. His heart is still beating while I watch it. How do we advance our knowledge and understanding? Well, we ultimately do the experiment, right? Hippocrates, we've got humors, and we're largely looking at, observing, living with, working with our patients. We start to dissect. We dissect animals. We get one view. We begin to dissect humans, and our knowledge advances, and then, hey, yeah, you make a vivisection of a reptile which has a circulatory system, and you see that it really is a circulatory system, right? So the thought experiment is good, and it may direct you, but at some point you really have to do the experiment, make something work, give you a concrete bit of evidence on which you can build your view and understanding of the world.
as a corollary, well, if we traced a couple theories that turned out not to be reasonable, are they bad theories? No, not necessarily, right? They're certainly part of the origin story of understanding circulation. And they are explanations which, at the time, are reasonably sufficient, right? In the writings of Hippocrates, you see a number of things that you would still hold, right? The physician has to know their patient. A 3-minute office visit is not going to be good enough to do that well. You're comfortable with that. The idea that a life in balance is good, and when things are out of balance, things don't go so well physiology-wise. Hey, you've all been through the final exam period, right? You remember that was quite upsetting both mentally and physically? And you probably think that it should be outlawed as cruel and inhumane punishments? Unfortunately, at some point you will have a job, and what walks in the clinic door, right, is going to be something different every hour, and you've got to be able to put it all together in very short order. So I will defend the final exam. I mean, even though I'm not giving you one, I still defend the final exam as being very important. And, hey, it'd be really nice if there were a single final exam across all of your biochemical study. But I'm not allowed to do that, so you don't have to worry. Yet. Okay. So, let's then formalize some things and extend our story a little bit. Because that was really just one example to set up some points. There's a lot more that goes into modern science than just doing the experiment. What is the first university to open in the West, and when did they do it? And let's see, who do you think it was? Was it the Germans? Who do you think it was? Ooh, thinking it's the English. So you're thinking Cambridge, Oxford. One of those is the oldest. So they're dating to sort of 1500. Renaissance, there's definitely a university that outdoes them by about 500 years, somewhere in the Western world. France, you believe in the French. No, it's not the French. Sorry. They definitely have some learning in salons, and, you know, they do those academic things. But remember, they also have, you know, short little men who are bullies who want to run the country. And there's that whole thing where heads roll around. Yeah, so France, well, hi, there's some instability. It was Italy, yes. The University of Bologna. And you chuckle because you now know that all higher education is just baloney. Making a preserved meat from which we borrow their name to make the lowest grade of preserved meat, and call it bologna. And 1088 AD is the University of Bologna. So when you say Western universities, yeah, it's Bologna, 1088. Now, what's fun about Western universities from then through the Renaissance and long after that is they didn't have scientists. What they had were natural philosophers. Let's see, what's the terminal degree that most of your faculty members hold? They have a doctorate in philosophy, right? The degree is the doctor of philosophy in a particular discipline, biochemistry and biophysics.
physical chemistry, inorganic chemistry. But it's a doctor of philosophy, which means that, hey, we're really all just philosophers. If only I could sit on a rock and watch the stream roll by, my day would be much more comfortable. All right, so there aren't scientists for a long time, but there are natural philosophers. And natural philosophers kind of have the academic rap that they do things which aren't particularly meaningful. And it's really other sorts of careers or occupations or skills which do the practical things. So let's take a moment and write down what the natural philosopher studied and then what was the occupation of the person who used what they were studying practically. Natural philosopher is the academic. The vocation is what the person does who actually uses that same knowledge in a practical outlet. All right, so there are natural philosophers who are interested in astronomy. Right? They're the astronomer. They follow the sun. They perish the thought, make a suggestion that the universe is centered around the sun and we just orbit it. Who makes their living by looking at the stars? Yep, give them a sextant and a clear night, and they'll tell you which way to sail. Right, so they're again looking at the stars, but they're using the stars for a very practical sort of way. So a natural philosopher might be interested in chemistry, right? What is the stuff of the universe? There are a whole lot of careers that are interested in chemistry. Most we would call them, say, how should we describe them? Right, so you make ethanol, you sell ethanol, right? You dig something out of the ground and you sell that like coal, right? You're doing chemistry, but you are doing chemistry in order to use that product. Right, you are finding deposits of gold, heating it up and refining it until you have pure gold, and then you're selling it. Right? It's all good chemistry stuff, but you're not really thinking about what it is. You're thinking about how to get it and how to get more of it and how to make more money for it. All right, so if you're a natural philosopher who's interested in the living things in the world, right, you sit and you're a natural philosopher about that. If you really want to do practical things, we call you a farmer, right? That's the practical outpouring of biology. You might raise plants, you might raise livestock, you might keep livestock from eating your plants, right? But you're really farming. And as a natural philosopher, you might be a physicist, but where do people who are really good with motion find a career? They are military men who direct the artillery. We're here, the enemy's there. How do we get our projectile to land on them and stop them from advancing? All right, so there's sort of this divide between the natural philosopher who thinks about things and describes things, and then the people who are working with the same bits of the material world, but have a practical vocation sort of reason for doing those things. And there's one particular discovery / interest which unifies both the practice and the natural philosophy, makes scientists out of the people who are interested in these areas of natural philosophy, and gives us fun opportunities in the laboratory today. Too tight. But it's better than what happens with the chalk eraser when you have a gap in the board. You usually bounce that in your hand right back at you. And that is, you'll notice there's no one who's really a natural philosopher in the Western tradition in math. It's more of a practical commerce sort of thing like arithmetic. And then in a few years, math becomes the hot topic. They get introduced into the academy, and then everybody else who's been doing all this sort of stuff says, yeah, this math thing could be useful. Let's do math. So, he said innocently, who's responsible for introducing math to chemistry? Right. So chemistry was a lot of fun prior to the introduction of math. It was, let's find something, let's isolate it, let's look at the pretty colors, let's mix it with something else and see if we can make another pretty color. Who introduces stoichiometry? The idea that we have a particular mass here, and through the reaction we make with mass of something else, so we can understand that. We are going to talk about Newton, and he did really like chemistry, but now this time it's a Frenchman, I'd say, who put the numbers in chemistry.
Lavoisier.
So, he's a Frenchman. He is a wealthy guy. He works for the king, essentially as a tax collector. The French Revolution comes along, and he and most of the other people who are sort of in the same profession get arrested by the new people in charge. Now, being a chemist, and right, so Lavoisier discovers oxygen, names it and identifies it, adds the math. He says, you know, I can do this, and he takes up his own defense. Right, so he acts as his own lawyer. He argues his case. They say, we're gonna decapitate you anyway, because you've been really bad. So he takes the people who work with him and he says, okay, they're going to decapitate me. I'm going to start talking. I want you to count how long I continue talking or how long my severed head continues talking. And maybe you'll learn something about physiology from it. So the guillotine falls and he's gone. 10 or 15 years later, they come back to his widow and say, you know, we were probably a little rash in killing your husband. We'll return some of your property. Have a nice day. So, about 1790 is the beginning of math and chemistry. Prior to that, it was lots of fun. I mean, it was colorful and pretty, and you were isolating things and you were describing them, but it wasn't quite as quantitative as it is today. Biology takes them a little bit longer. Gregor Mendel's really the first one to do numbers in biology. Unfortunately for him, no one understands his papers for about 60 years. 55 years, 60 years. So his work is lost, and then people rediscover it when they start doing quantitative genetics, and they say, this guy knew what was going on years earlier. So from the page for today, there is linked a paper where biologists did a survey. They looked at papers in biology. They counted the number of equations that appeared in the text, in the appendix materials, the extra materials, and then they did a correlation plot with the number of citations that a paper receives, and they found that if the biology paper has very few equations, they get a lot of citations, and if they have more and more equations, they get fewer and fewer citations. And so their conclusion was, you shouldn't write equations in your biology papers. You should put it all in the extra materials or the supplementary materials at the end. Now, what's fun is that scientific journals allow you to write a letter in to say, hey, this article wasn't very good, and we think it's wrong for these reasons. And so a lot of people wrote in and said, maybe we should just teach biologists math, because it is a really good description of everything. So they caught a lot of flack for that good bit of advice. Guy said Newton, so we got to talk Newton. He's a young man. He's known to be quite brilliant, if not slightly abrasive in his personality. And so he goes off to the English universities to be trained, but there's a plague. And so his family calls him home. You're going to sit at home where it's safe. There's no one around. You're not going to get sick. You know what that's like, right? I mean, we don't call it a plague anymore. You get the idea. And so he sits in his mother's orchard, and watches the apples fall in the autumn, thinking, you know, I could really be back at school, taking those exams, having those stimulating intellectual discussions, you know, doing the things that I want to do. But instead, all I am here is I want to watch the apples fall. And if you think about an apple on a tree, it's well attached to the tree by its stem until at one point the tree is weakening that stem ever so much that suddenly the mass of the apple causes it to fall. And so Newton says, oh, wait a minute. The apple is still, all of a sudden the apple accelerates. That's instantaneous acceleration. I must understand this math. Let me invent the calculus in order to approach that problem. So as a student, he develops calculus to solve the problem of falling apples. Right now, the apocryphal story is that he's sitting under the apple tree and it falls on him. He says, well, there's gravity. I slightly embellish. But he develops calculus specifically to solve a problem that he sees when he can't do anything else. Eventually, the plague is gone. The bans are lifted. He returns to school happily. He finishes school, he becomes a professor, and what does he study? He sets up his own lab. What's his lab studying? Is it calculus? Is it gravity and physics? Nope, it's alchemy. And you're like, whoa, wait a minute. Isn't that pseudoscience? It's bad? Allow me to explain. Cultural appropriation is something that regularly happens. When a civilization falls, often some of their knowledge is carried off elsewhere. And so if we think about Europe and around through what is now Turkey into northern Africa, right, the distinction between the Christian world and the Muslim world, right, there's a lot of back and forth between those areas. What you know as Baghdad today, right, you don't really think of as a seat of learning, not terribly much, because you have the skewed view that, hey, Baghdad's in Iraq, and Iraq is always in conflict, and they can never get anything together. Well, let's see. Just looking for one word. I know where it is. There it is. It's right about there. Is it there? No, I'm going to have to remember it. Let's see. Iraq, Mesopotamia, the Fertile Crescent. It had an earlier name that you'd recognize as being a really cool place. And so when it comes to modern writing, right, it's in that area, in that region where first things are written down. Right, and that writing gets exported to the West. Right, and the West does things. There's a really great empire in Rome. If you ever visit Rome, they have little maps of we were this big at this year, and we were big at this year, and we were big at this year. Right, all the way into England, there are Roman roads, but there are none in Scotland, because the Scottish were never conquered. Haile Selassie, he was never conquered. There's a whole religion, Rastafarianism. But they worship him as, right, the greatest African, the embodiment of Christ returned, because unlike the rest of Africa, Ethiopia never colonized. Ethiopia was last, whichever country it was, never colonized, so it's the best. Okay, so what happens is Rome eventually falls. No political commentary here. They had a leader who didn't care. That's okay. No reference to Monday. Okay, good. See, there you can call him. Okay, I mentioned that. Rome falls, and what happens is people come up from the south, and they take that knowledge, right, and they take it back into the Islamic world, and they're really good at copying it and studying it. And eventually then they get overrun by the West again, and it comes back, but instead of being what you'd know as chemistry, it's alchemy. But then again, if you know the Arabic Al Jazeera, the English language news network, is the peninsula, if you were to translate it into English, right, news about the Arabian Peninsula, Al Jazeera. So it's simply the chemistry, right? All of the Western knowledge has come down. It's been maintained. It's been added to. When it comes back, it has a different name. And so Newton goes into the work of alchemy, right? The whole thing of, let's take base metals and turn them into gold. Let's generate the Philosopher's Stone. But in doing all of those sorts of experiments, right, trying to do that, you learn lots of other things about chemistry. Right? And so it's not necessarily that bad. Ultimately, then, alchemy falls out of favor in the mid-1700s. It's like, this is really not chemistry. We want to be an honest academic discipline. We got to bury all references to this alchemy thing. We're not going to make gold out of anything else. It's there. It comes from space. We'll use what we can find, but we're going to give up on trying to make it. And so largely, alchemy is replaced by Lavoisier and the other great chemists. Ooh, could it be Robert Boyle? Jacques Charles? Amadeo Avogadro? The great chemists. They all have laws named after them. Now, alchemy kind of goes off into the backwater of it's an untouchable area of science until the 1950s. And then people begin reading the alchemy work and they say, hey, wait a minute. It wasn't all imaginary quest to make gold. They really learned a lot of chemistry and set the stage for what we know today. And so alchemy comes back. I believe there's a link to a History of Science journal which had an entire issue on the history of alchemy and its origins and its disappearance and its reappearance. That was in the 1940s, 1950s that it sort of came back into not necessarily fashion, but at least we could talk about it in a rational way without immediately saying, witchcraft, witchcraft, no. Which leads to the point of there are scientific fads, there are fashions, there are things which become popular and then fade away. Alchemy is one of those. Largely, Newton's work in alchemy was swept under the rug because everybody wanted to take him serious as a physicist and a mathematician. And so they really kind of, sure, he did some alchemy, but that was just for fun. Right? We're not going to talk about that. This comes into play, right? It's very similar today. There are areas of investigation which become really remarkably popular, and then they kind of pass away. And pass away as in become less popular. If you wanted a good example, I would probably cite high technology more so than science, because you'd be more familiar with the examples. Anyone own an NFT? Anyone know someone who paid millions of dollars for one and can't sell them now for pennies? Are you familiar with this generative AI thing, which is the big wave of popularity? Has it been that useful for you? Modestly, sort of, kind of. It causes some comic relief from time to time. Right, so science is like that because science is an endeavor of people. Right, and people are given to whims and interests and they get excited about things and then their excitement for those things fall. Yes, when I said I could make the Taylor Swift references, you said, yes, make Taylor Swift references. But when I made the Ricky Martin reference, like, yeah, I know that song, but mostly I chuckle at it. Right? Trends come and go. Do you wear plaid and live in Seattle? Do you wear tight leather pants and have a big teased hairdo? Okay. All right. So we got to remember that science, understanding the world around us, is definitely a human endeavor. In that way, humans are, you know, given with all the characteristics that we have. We can do really good things. We can be really mean to our neighbor, too. And so there are up and downs, ebbs and flows, right? You want to go to graduate school. There are hot topics that are well-funded that you probably work in, but by the time you're ready to start your own career, that may no longer be the exciting thing. Let's see. His view of science as a whole, and then we'll maybe leave you with one practical example. Okay, so Thomas Kuhn is a historian. He is around the 1930s at a small college, and he is assigned a class of liberal arts students, and those class of liberal arts students are who learn the history of science. And he says, well, wait a minute here. I'm a historian. I'm not a scientist. I read books on politics and geopolitical movements and where people groups go. And so he gets assigned to teach this class, as many people do, get assigned to teach classes that aren't their area of interest. And so he sets about trying to read everything he can on science, not necessarily the ins and outs of what's the structure of the atom and when did we learn that, but along the lines of what are people doing and how is science working. He ultimately writes a large book in 1962. So it takes science a while to develop. That's a good 30 years for him to develop his ideas on the history of science. But his book and it's titled The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. You probably don't want to read it, but if you ever need some good bedtime put you to sleep reading, I'd recommend it. And largely his view on science is that there are two real phases for scientific understanding. The vast majority of the science that happens is what he uses, what he describes with the term normal science. And in normal science, everyone agrees on a general intellectual framework. That is, we have a pretty good idea of the paradigms, and those people who are working in science are making small incremental discoveries within that framework, right? They're building out knowledge. They're fleshing those ideas out. And so normal science is the baseline science. Now, there are some people who have a different view of science. They really don't like being called normal scientists because, well, that's not very special. You want to be a special scientist. But what then in Kuhn's view breaks normal science is that there is some new discovery, some new revolution, such that the paradigm shifts from this is the way we think the world works to now there's something new. And normal science then moves to that new paradigm, that new thing, and begins to flesh it out, and there's a period of learning, and that period of learning continues, and we build and understand, and then somewhere along the way we discover something which is new and revolutionary, moving in that direction for another period of normal science. So you might describe his view of science like punctuated equilibrium, where everything's nice and steady, and there's a dramatic change, and then it's nice and steady again. And so if you think about some scientific revolutions, there is a large period of work. There's a lot of setup before something comes and really solves a problem. Let's see. Mendel, he's interested in heritable characteristics, whether our peas are yellow or green, whether they're round or wrinkled. Now, of course, you've eaten in the cafeteria, so you know that all peas are gray and wrinkled, right? And you kind of wonder what Mendel was up to, because peas, and they always have that little bit of yellow residue that's left on the plate when you're done. and you wonder, that's not how butter behaves. What is that? Okay. All right. So Mendel describes the gene, a particle of inheritance, but he doesn't associate it with a macromolecule. As the macromolecules are discovered, a lot of people favor protein as being the genetic material, because there are 20 monomer units that currently find that regularly find their way into the polymer, so there's a great deal of diversity. That looks like a really great way to contain information. And hey, those nucleic acid things, you know, they're very regular, but they really only have 4 different units, and I don't know how much I can encode with 4 different units. That doesn't seem like the genetic material. And so from the rediscovery of Mendel through shortly after D-Day, 1944, it's an open question as to what the genetic material is. Until there is one very famous experiment where they take a virulent strain of bacteria and a non-virulent strain, and they purify the virulent strain into nucleic acids and proteins and carbohydrates, and they mix each one in turn with the non-virulent strain, and they ask one which transforms to become virulent. The genetic material is DNA. Okay, so the idea of normal science, something new happens, there's a change shift in paradigm, everyone sort of settles out with a new paradigm, and we begin to learn more and more and better our understanding. Science takes a long time, right? Hippocrates is thinking the heart's really important in, say, 430 BC, by the time he's grown up to an adult. It's not until close to 1550 that we get a full picture of circulatory physiology. And you did say you were familiar with the Nobel Prize, right? So who won the Nobel Prize in 1972 in chemistry? Oh, you're familiar with the Nobel Prize in general. You don't know every winner? Nobel Prize, I'll forgive you for that. I'm mostly teasing you. But the Nobel Prize in 1972 in chemistry was given to Christian Anfinsen. And Christian Anfinsen took ribonuclease A, that is bovine pancreatic ribonuclease, so the pancreas digestive organ feeds base and a number of enzymes into the duodenum, digestion of the small intestine, duodenum, ileum, jejunum, right, into the small intestine to finish digestion. Ribonuclease A is a small protein, 124 amino acids, 1, 2, 3, 4 disulfide bonds. So instead of being just one linear chain, one part and one part are coupled together 1, 2, 3, 4 times. Right, and so through the 1960s, what he studies is fully reduced and denatured ribonuclease A. You break all 4 disulfide bonds, you take away its structure, you let it sit on the windowsill, given enough time, it will readopt its native structure and return to its activity, which is you put in RNA and it makes it into smaller bits of RNA. It's technically an endonuclease, it's not an exonuclease, even though it's really small. So he describes ribonuclease refolding as the way that he describes it is the thermodynamic hypothesis. That is, the native structure of a polypeptide is the structure of lowest free energy under any set of conditions. And so when we heat and denature ribonuclease A, it adopts a free and flexible structure, because that's the lowest energy form, entropy wins. Look at your room when you go home tonight. Wait 3 weeks. Entropy always wins. When you cool that down, right, and you return to physiological conditions, the native state is the folded functional form of the protein, right? So he wins the Nobel Prize in 1972 for that. Who won the Nobel Prize in chemistry last year?
I don't know their names, but they did that protein folding software.
Mm-hmm. So there are 2 people for AlphaFold. And then there's one fellow who was in protein design using slightly different methodologies. But the Nobel Prize is largely for being able to take a string of amino acids, a sequence, and predict what that three-dimensional structure is going to be. Right. So from the 1960s describing that this happens, it takes until 2018 or so, when AlphaFold became first released into the world. It takes that long in order to get a solution to that problem. Now, there are some other questions in protein folding which are not solved, but predicting a structure is pretty well automated, more or less. Now, were there people working in protein chemistry between 1972 and last year? Right. Were they doing a whole lot of structure determinations? Were they doing a lot of sequencing? Were they doing a lot of experiments in between? Did we have a period of normal science? Right. And then the computer scientists who were working on methods to, you knew it as AlphaFold. What did that company do before they turned to the protein folding problem? Their software was called AlphaGo, and it played the more complicated version of chess that you'll find in the Eastern world. Rocks, one side black, one side white, based on how you flip them over, so there are more combinations. So they were working on building so what they're really doing is they're experimenting in artificial intelligence and deep learning in order to solve a problem which has a clear starting state, a clear finishing state, right? It's a very tractable problem. And once they were good at Go, they looked around and said, okay, where's there another problem where we have a large set of training data and a clear idea if we get the right answer? And they said, hey, this biochemistry thing looks available. Now, do they solve that problem because they're really good at everything? No, they build on what came before them. Remember, Newton said, if I have seen further than anyone else, it's because I stand on the shoulders of giants, meaning that everything that he's read led him to the point where he can make a small incremental advance. All right, so we turn our attention from science, we have a little bit more to say about the scientific method, into biochemistry, particularly next week. So stay warm, and I'll see you roughly this time next week.